please welcome a Renaissance man, Steve Inske. Hey,
thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Nothing good.
Wow. Thank you for that introduction. Really appreciate it. Thank you for the warm welcome here to Wilmington. I've really enjoyed myself. It's an amazing community. And even if I didn't think it was an amazing community, you know I'd tell you that it was because you have arranged things so that I'm speaking with the guns of a battleship aimed directly at me. But I didn't need that persuasion because it is beautiful. I've enjoyed looking around. I spent last night at the Blockade Runner in Wrightsville. Yeah, you can applaud. Got to see the sunrise this morning. Woke up a little late for me, about 6 o'clock, and saw the sunrise at 6:08 over the ocean. It was beautiful. I want to note, as most people in this room probably know, that hotel was severely damaged in the hurricane. They've just reopened. They're still renovating in there, but the parts that are finished are beautiful. And I am really impressed. Just coming in from the airport, I expected to see more damage. You people seem to have cleaned up very nicely, and I hope you're all proud of that. It's a beautiful city. It's a beautiful city. I'm honored to be here to talk about my job a little bit. It's the best job in the world, not because of the hours. I get up about 2:45 or so, 2:45 or 3 o'clock in the morning, depending on how many times I hit the snooze button. I'm in at work by 4. The program goes on the air at 5. But because of the things that you learn and the people that you meet, it is the best job in the world. Now, when I tell people that I'm a reporter, some people become very sympathetic. Recently, oh, I'm so sorry. You have to cover that horrible news all the time. And it just must be a really terrible time to be a journalist. But this is not correct. This presumption is not correct. It's a great time to be a journalist because you go on the air and you say the craziest things that you never in a million years thought you would say. And they're just true. Being a journalist is unlike many other professions. In that, I mean, it's different than being a doctor, say, or a lawyer, or many other things, because in order to be a journalist, you need to have no particular qualifications, ability, or experience of any kind. And if you doubt me, turn on the television sometime and look at what you see. No, there's great people doing TV, just maybe not all of them. That ability to be a journalist with a lack of experience, ability, or knowledge is actually enshrined in the Constitution, ladies and gentlemen. And it's quite meaningful. And I take it seriously for this reason. As a journalist, I'm nobody special, nobody important, nobody who's been elected to any high position, but I am a citizen, as is everyone in this room, which gives me the right to ask any question that I want and to expect an answer. And that's all that I need. And I'm honored that everyone in this room has come together as citizens to support the work of this radio station, which in turn supports what we do at NPR. So please give yourselves another round of applause. There were a few experiences in my life that in my mind shaped my approach to journalism, and one had to do with the high school radio station in Carmel, Indiana, at Carmel High School. I wasn't really even aware that there was a high school radio station until I learned that my brother, my older brother, had tried out and had been accepted to be on the staff of the high school radio station. And I immediately thought, if that idiot can do that, my brother's amazing, but you know how you are with your brother. If he can do that, I can do that. So I tried out for the staff, and I ended up being the color man and later the play-by-play guy doing high school basketball and football games for Carmel High School. And I have a particular memory of a regional championship game. The Carmel football team is traditionally quite good. They've won a bunch of state championships. Their arch rivals were Warren Central, which has also won a bunch of state championships. And there was a regional championship game, and it was fought on a muddy field, and it was really close. And the Carmel Greyhounds lost on a last-minute field goal, 17-15. And my job was to relate the facts of that game, without regard to who won or lost, to pass on the facts. The Monday after that crushing defeat, the faculty advisor, effectively the general manager of the radio station, said, "I received a call from Joe Pate, who was the guy who called the Purdue University football and basketball games and who I'd listened to for years and who I very much admired." And he said, "Joe Pate was listening to that game and appreciated that you gave the facts and didn't lose your mind about the outcome." 25 years later, I ran into my old friend who had been the tailback on the losing Carmel football team. And I related that story to him about how the game that he had lost, that I had called it straight, called it the way that it was, and that I was very proud that I'd been complimented in this way. And he said, "Well, that's really good for you, but I'm still bitter and I can't talk about that game." That ball game. But that's the job. The job is to look at what's in front of you, see it for yourself, learn everything you can, and pass on everything that you can. And because of the nature of the media, we're often doing that in real time. And so we have to be honest about what we know and what we don't know. I try very hard not to report on the future. It's hard to find reliable reports from the future. So it's not my job to tell you who's going to win the game, actually. Other people can predict that if they would like, but I'm going to get the events to you as they unfold. I learned a little bit later how hard it can be to get at the facts. It's not always like a sporting event where you go and you get a seat in the press box and it's a pretty good seat and you can just follow the action in front of you. There are things that are harder to get to. There are things that are going on behind the scenes. I don't want to shock people, but occasionally people lie to you. And you have to go and go and go. I had another formative experience after 9/11. NPR sent me to Afghanistan, sent me twice to Afghanistan. And in early 2002, so this is not long after 9/11, the Taliban, who had controlled the country and sheltered Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, had been driven out of power, but they were still around in the mountains and so forth. And I was staying in the city of Kandahar, which had been the heart of Taliban territory, but was then controlled by forces friendly to the United States. And word came of a raid more than 100 miles away, up in the mountains of a province called Orizgan. And the United States military, our own military, had conducted this raid on people they described as Al-Qaeda figures, and they'd killed about 15 people, and they'd taken 27 prisoners. And it was advertised as a big raid. But local people in that area began to say, "No, this is not true. You got the wrong people. You made a mistake. We actually support the United States, and the people who you killed supported the United States." There was no way to check out this claim except to go. Now, 100 miles, I mean, Raleigh's probably not even 100 miles from here, is it? I don't know. It's not a very long drive in the United States. 100 miles in Afghanistan in 2002 was like preparing for a trip to the moon. It was going to be over the mountains. It was February. The roads were going to be terrible. And so I went to this guy. We found a guy in Kandahar who would rent us a Land Rover with four-wheel drive. And we went up into the mountains. Sometimes there wasn't even a road, and the vehicle drove on riverbeds. And then we got higher and higher up into the mountains, and it began to snow. And it was about the time that we were at the very highest point in the mountains where snow was on the ground the next morning. It took us 2 days to drive the 100 miles. Snow was on the ground the next morning, and we were going around a curve looking out over the mountains. It was about that time that we realized that the four-wheel drive on the vehicle we had rented did not work. And there was one curve where we kind of went out over the side and nearly went over the edge. But we made it to the other side. We sat with a large number of Afghans who told us their side of the story. And it's still difficult to know what is true and what is false. We went over to the place the United States military forces had attacked. We looked at the destruction there, but it's just destruction. We talked to the local people who said, we support the United States, and you killed the wrong people. But I said, how can we prove that? And they said, the CIA has been here. And they admitted the truth. And they went to the families of the people who were killed and paid them all compensation. We went and found one of those people who allowed us to take a photograph of his $1,000 that he was given for his relative who was killed. And we had a story, and we had information, and we reported that the next day, and news got back to Washington. The military, for a time, continued to deny that they had killed the wrong people and imprisoned the wrong people. But after about two or three more days, the truth became apparent to everyone, and the 27 people they had imprisoned were released. I appreciate that applause. That was not a pleasant story for me to tell on the air in 2002. I'm sure it's not a pleasant story for a lot of people to have heard here, but it was the truth. And there is power in the truth. And it matters. And I think that people in the military themselves, in fact, I know this is the case, people in the military themselves would generally rather the truth be told about what they're doing or what is being done than otherwise, because they want to do their jobs well. They want to be directed by an informed citizenry, because we're their bosses, aren't we? And because they are in a business where too many lies get you killed. It was important to tell the truth, and it was also really, really hard. It entailed some risk, and it entailed days of traveling. It entailed going there to look for yourself. I think that those same principles apply with every kind of story that we do. My job, with your help, with your support, is to look for myself, to learn for myself, to listen for myself, and also to meet different kinds of people. People who are completely different from anyone in this room, who have completely different views from anyone in this room, or just to meet your neighbor who may have a totally different view than you do. Maybe voted the opposite way in the 2016 election. You can't understand why that moron would have done that, right? You know, and it might be your mother that you're actually thinking about. You know, it might be your brother. It's important to reach across that divide. It's important to reach around the world and listen to people who have different viewpoints than we do, and it's important to do that in our communities. In 2012, a couple of NPR colleagues and I, again with your support, decided to follow up on what had been called the Arab Spring, the revolutions of 2011 that changed the governments in Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt. And we decided to check up on those countries through a gigantic road trip. We drove about 2,700 miles from Tunis all the way across Libya to Cairo. In retrospect, that little window of time, 2012, the summer of 2012, was the only moment in history when we could possibly have done that and come through alive. Things were worse before, things have been worse since. We got to the city of Benghazi in this late spring of 2012, And we heard that there were some Islamists who were going to hold a demonstration. And so we drove in that direction to see what kind of demonstration the Islamists would put on. Well, these were not just ordinary citizens. These were actually members of a militia. So they brought their machine gun trucks to their to the demonstration. Sort of like you guys brought the battleship. Same kind of thing. You bring machine gun trucks to political demonstrations. Is this right, Mayor? Is this how it works? There was like a convoy of like 50, 60 trucks, and they've got these guns mounted on the back, and there are tons of people on them. And we kind of merged into traffic and realized we'd inadvertently become part of the protest march. At one point, all the traffic stopped for whatever reason, and people began getting out of their vehicles and standing by the side of the road. And we got out too, and we started talking with people, and we talked with this young man. And I just went back last night and looked at the story to check the quote, to make sure I didn't misremember the quote. I asked the guy something to the effect of, "What is it that you want to do?" And he said, "Kill the infidels." Well, I'm thinking, I may qualify as an infidel to you. I didn't actually say that. But I probably didn't need to call attention to it, really. I mean, I stand out in many places that I go. But I think it was valuable to hear that. It was valuable to hear that awful sentiment expressed in that way, and gave me, along with a lot of other things, a richer understanding of what was going on in Libya. And I am really sad to say I was not entirely surprised a couple of months later when the U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens, who we'd also met on that trip, was killed in Benghazi, Libya. But in that same journey, I got a picture of the possibilities of that country. We saw ancient Roman ruins that seemed to me to be grander than Rome. We met people who were eager for democracy and eager for freedom and had stories of having been tortured under the previous regime and wanted something better. By going there and visiting, you had a sense of the full humanity of the people who were there. I'm pleased to say that Libya is one of the places that I've played golf. Because also in Benghazi, we were driving by and saw this golf course made out in the sand. It was a golf course made of sand. And there were these kids out there playing, and they would have this little 1 square foot of AstroTurf. And so you'd carry that and put it down and whack your ball off the AstroTurf. It's pretty awesome. And then go to the green, which was brown, and putt across the sand into the hole. And I have tape of this. I can play you the tape. I asked this young man, this 12-year-old talented golfer, "Who's your favorite golfer?" He says, "Tiger Woods." Which is another touching thing to think about, how far the image and the idea and the story of America has spread. You go to the most difficult places on Earth. You go to some of the most challenging places on Earth. You go to places that are rivals or enemies of the United States, and you are courteously welcomed, even by the people who quite courteously tell you they'd like to kill the infidels. They're very courteous about it. You are courteously welcomed, and in a great many places, you discover you have encountered someone who admires the United States, admires what we have, wishes they could come here, wishes they could make their country in some way more like the United States, wishes for democracy, wishes for some of the very things that drive us crazy and frustrate us. Our political system is so frustrating. Try to live under another one, and you feel the difference. I think it is vitally important to reach across the world in that way and listen to people in different places, like Iran or China, where I've also traveled, and just hear their stories. And it is vitally important to do that here, vitally important to do that now. You should be very proud that your station is in the middle of a project that is attempting to do that. Rachel is hosting a series of programs, as a number of you must know, as many of you must know, where people of widely different political viewpoints agree to sit across a table from one another and just talk and are compelled to listen. Do they sort of listen, Rachel? Do they listen as well as talk?
This is one of them.
Oh, really? All right, good for you. That's great. We have actually one of the participants over here sitting next to Rachel. Even after being interviewed by you, she's willing to sit next to you. That's great. Oh, she has more to say. I can't wait. I can't wait. No, I think it's really great that you're doing that. Rachel recorded an interview with me yesterday. It was the first thing I did upon arriving in Wilmington. And Rachel is superb because she's super courteous, and then she asks a hard question. And the first question was very elegant and very complicated, but one part of the question was basically, did you guys in the media screw up your coverage of the 2016 election? She's like, no, I didn't really mean that. But that was part of it. You were noting that President Obama did an interview with NPR after the election and was unhappy with the media coverage. I'm happy to put that on the table and suggest that there are many things I'm sure we could improve, but that I think NPR, perhaps in contrast with some other news organizations, did all right. And if we did all right, it's because we listened to different kinds of people and reported honestly on what they were saying. One reason I'm really proud to hear of your project is because we've attempted to do similar things over the years. In 2016, throughout the course of the election, we had a series of Morning Edition programs that we called Divided States. And we went into a variety of communities, Atlanta, Cincinnati, a couple of others, and we spent extended amounts of time with a small group of voters of very different viewpoints on one morning's program, and then the next morning brought them around to sit around the table and talk to one another. And that was an opportunity for us to hear about the widely different viewpoints that people have in this country, and also hear about how they got to that point. Now, the idea of listening to the person on the other side of the political divide who you think is an idiot, in fact, you're sure they're an idiot, in fact, you can prove they're an idiot, the idea is not that you're going to suddenly agree with them, or necessarily that they're going to agree with you, but that you better understand where they're coming from, which is a vital thing to do in a democracy where we're not all going to agree. In fact, we should not all agree. I can think of a country where everyone says they agree all the time, but it's hard to go to North Korea and participate in that joyful experience. There's a very small round of applause over there. It's hard to go to North Korea, and so we're stuck with the United States of America, where there are 320 million and some of us, and there are going to be more, and we're going to have different views, and there's going to be a new generation with new ideas, some of which will be old ideas, and some of the arguments repeat themselves forever over time. As a student of history, I have learned that the debate between the North and the South in the pre-Civil War years took on some of the same rhetoric that we use now. Even though the issues are different and the conditions are different, we in many ways talk the same way and repeat the arguments forever. And that's just a reality of human nature, because there's always another generation coming and going through experiences and reflecting those experiences and what they say. It's a never-ending argument. I once heard a politician in New York say that one of the things he has learned about politics is that nothing is ever over. You never have a debate that's, oh, that's settled. That is, we're done with that issue, you know? I mean, and there have been moments when people have thought that, you know? Barack Obama was elected in 2008. Okay, that whole race issue in America, that's settled. We got that taken care of. We have transcended race. I think most people would now agree we haven't, but that was still a profound event that we should understand as a profound event and that had long-lasting effects in America. And we've learned that the election of a president is just the beginning of that president's story. Whatever people thought the election of Donald Trump would mean in 2016, I bet you didn't predict all of the things that have happened since quite precisely, did you? No? Some people are like, yeah, I knew. There's a lot of arguing to be had. There's a lot of arguing to be had in our system, and that has affected what this president does and doesn't do, just as it affected the previous president and the president before him and the president before him. Democracy is a giant rolling argument, and it is vital that we listen not only to the people who agree with us, but the people who we disagree with. We may learn from them, and even if we still think they're wrong, we will better understand how to debate them, fight them, argue with them, whatever it is that you think you need to do. You need to understand your fellow citizens. And that leads to what I would suggest is my final thought about the way that I think about my job as a journalist. And again, I'm just a citizen, no better or worse than any of you, maybe worse than a good number of you, but no better than any of you. And I think of a good news organization as an intelligence agency for citizens. We are getting you information so that you can make the right decision as citizens. The president has the CIA and other agencies to bring him the best information so that he can read that presidential daily brief, if he chooses to read the presidential daily brief, or absorb the information however he wants. The president has this intelligence agency to give him information so that he can decide what to do. Well, let's remember that the president, whoever he or she may be, has a boss. You're the boss. We're the boss. We need intelligence agencies that give us straight information. And if I'm doing my job right, if NPR is doing its job right, if WHQR is doing the job right, we're serving as your intelligence agency, which means we need to help you keep track of your friends, but perhaps more important, help you keep track of the people you disagree with, the people you worry about, your adversaries. We're here to give you, if we succeed, the whole picture. I'm grateful to have a few minutes to talk with you today. I look forward to listening and learning from you through those cards that some of you submitted earlier. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of the afternoon. Thank you very much.
You can get